You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, I'm joined by Ivor Gaber and Sebastian Borger to discuss the day's biggest stories, including the results of regional elections in Germany over the weekend, a warning shot to Merkel, but what's the real story behind the results? Turkish warplanes have struck against Kurdish militant camps in northern Iraq after a car bombing in Ankara that security officials said involved a fighter of the Kurdistan Workers' Party. We consider where this could lead. Plus, today's the last full day of campaigning for US presidential hopefuls before primaries in five states tomorrow. Republican frontrunner Donald J. Trump could all but wrap up the GOP nomination. That's all ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome to today's edition of Midori House, and a warm welcome to my guests today, the London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung Sebastian Borger and Ivor Gaber, Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex. Gentlemen, welcome both to the programme. Today we start the programme in Germany. Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats endured a difficult day, as she described it, in state elections at the weekend. While right-wingers made gains in a vote dominated by discussion over the migrant crisis, many others on the left and the Greens, supporters of Merkel's open border policy, also made gains too. So perhaps rather than narrative of nationalism, of a shift right, anti-immigration per se, maybe the weekend speaks more to a country that's maybe more polarised than ever before over the issue. Sebastian, let me turn to you then and ask that question. We're used to seeing in state elections or regional elections the incumbents in central government getting a bit of a bashing. It's often what happens. Is this what's happened here, or is it about this kind of animus surrounding migration?
I think it is the latter. I'm afraid I disagree with your introduction in that sense, that I do think it is a lurch to the right. Hmm. The Greens made a little bit of gains in Baden-Württemberg, the very prosperous southwest of the country, but mainly because the Social Democrats lost by, you know, a double-digit figure. Hmm. So, overall, I don't think you can get away from the fact that there is this right-wing party, anti-immigration, anti-Euro. They profess to still think the European Union is a good thing, but I to be honest, have my doubts. Mm. Who get 15% in Baden-Württemberg, which is with Bavaria, the most prosperous state in this anyway fairly rich country, and get 24% in a state of the former East. I mean that is a severe setback for the establishment, not just for Merkel, but for the Social Democrats and the Greens as well.
Now, however, that strikes me as interesting because we've seen this across Europe, haven't we, that the narrative around the migration crisis is causing, well, almost seismic shifts politically. Should we have expected to see this in Germany as well? Do you think there was I don't know if it's a complacency or a sense that maybe somehow Germany seemed to be immune to some of the worst excesses we'd seen elsewhere?
Well, immune up to a point. There has been a series, as Sebastian would know better than me, a series of ultra-right parties rising and then falling over the years. And this is not complacency, because obviously the migration of 1.1 million and counting refugees into Germany within 12 months is on a scale we've never seen before. But nonetheless, I found the election results quite interesting because, clearly the AfD have done very well, but there were... It's difficult to find an overall trend on the three Länder that went to polls. They had ended up with three different winners. Now, maybe I'm sure that there are good reasons for it, but it does mean that the right surge that you described, I won't say is confined to the former East Germany, but does look by far and away stronger there than elsewhere.
No, I disagree. Sorry. Again, there is a surge in the West as well. You know, you
no,
don't
I said
get
stronger. There is clearly
stronger. It's much stronger. But look, the Easterners have been much more fluent in their political affiliations from the start, since the wall fell. And interestingly, in Saxony-Anhalt, where this election took place, they were the first who, as Ivar quite rightly says, elected a right-wing, even further right-wing party with double-digit figures. It's disappeared. Before that, we've had similar results in the west of the country, and they disappear. That is the, I suppose, that is the hope that sane people will have. And the other, I mean, the positive thing you have to give it to them.
Let's find some positive somewhere.
Well, I think it is positive that we've got a turnout of 70% in Länder elections, which normally you're lucky to get 50, 60% out. Mm. You know, a lot of people who wouldn't normally go to the polls did go and gave a bloody nose to the establishment. I mean, actually, they asked, sorry, just to that last thought, they asked AfD voters, why did you vote for this party? And I think something like three quarters said it's a protest vote. It's nothing to do with their policies. I wouldn't have the first clue what their policies are. And of course, they haven't got, what the name suggests, they have got an alternative for Germany. Well, they don't. There's nothing there. But it's a protest vote. And now, let's see how they'll do in Parliament.
Can I just ask Sebastian, who's clearly, presumably, you originate from Germany.
I'm Bavarian.
Bavarian. Well, that is part
and
of
proud.
last time I checked.
Only just.
But I just wanted to question you that, actually, you're right about the turnout in the West, but in the Saxony-Anhalt, the turnout was only just over 60%. And the other question I wanted to ask you, and I'm afraid my detailed knowledge of London politics in Germany is not as good as it perhaps should be, but the left alternative, the left of the Social Democrats, came third with 16% of the vote.
Yes, now, but there used to be second. That's the point. That's my point. Even in Saxony-Anhalt, they would have expected to be above 20%. The left, of course, the former communists, and they had a severe setback themselves. And you have to measure turnout compared to what turnout was 10 years ago, 44%, and it was something like 51 5 years ago. So above 60, even in Saxony-Anhalt, is a great result. Simply in terms of democratic participation.
Let me ask you then, Sebastian, how this changes politics. Because I'm, you know, looking in the German newspapers, that was very much the narrative. It's talking about, you know, a punishment for Merkel. It does tend to sort of personalise it slightly. Yeah. But it talked more about this wider shift, a change in politics. Is that what we have here? Is this an enduring change? It was interesting you mentioned that point about how many people are quite happy to say in exit polling that they're just making a protest. But is there something more profound happening?
I don't think so. I think there is a potential, as you pointed out, as in any other developed democracy in Western Europe, there's a potential of between 10 and 15, maybe even 20% of people who vote right-wing, if they get a chance.
Far right. I mean, I think voting right-wing is conservative, is Merkel. I mean, I'm just...
Well, no, I would call them right of centre. But you know,
fair enough.
Never mind. Yeah, okay, right-wing or even extreme right, whatever you want to call them. But I think it is a protest vote in the sense that people are... people don't see where this refugee policy is leading to. I think Merkel realized that about the turn of the year, and that's why she has, of course, moved a long way from the initial talk of we will do it, we can do it in September. But she hasn't moved quite far enough, and people see the obstacles, of course, that are in her way. I mean, she was always thinking it should be a European solution. The problem is the other Europeans, Great Britain included, just refused to play ball.
Well, I mean, Ivan, and that's a good point, isn't it? That Merkel, even through this difficult weekend, has said, look, you know, we need to find a pan-European solution for what is a European problem. I don't know, at what point did that cease being pragmatic and, you know, verge firmly into territory of just being wishful thinking?
Oh, bloody mind. I mean, I have to say, on a personal level, I have enormous admiration, particularly today, with Merkel saying we are sticking with it. But clearly, She's desperate for the European Union to come up with to rescue her, and the signs are not very good at the moment, to be honest. And particularly, I mean, even if there was a possibility of a deal being done with Turkey a week ago, the event, and we'll move on to that. But Erdogan is just making it very, very difficult for any sort of European deal to be done, which doesn't do anything other than look like a complete mess.
Sebastian, it's clearly, you know, a very testing political time domestically and on a European basis for Merkel. Do you think that she made a serious miscalculation with this policy, or maybe more broadly with her approach to the policy, her rhetoric? You mentioned that she's sort of not eased back, but she's slightly kind of repositioned herself. Did she make an error, or do you think that, as Ivor says, you know, actually she has stuck to her guns on this, and maybe if she's taking the long view, she'd say, look, I have to stick with this policy. It's too important to be politically fickle.
But in the long run, we're all dead. No. I think the clear mistake was in September to say we must help these desperate people. That was correct and right and to her everlasting credit. What she also should have said, but there is a limit, and it needs to be done on a European basis. And also she should have said, we are open, but we are also open. You know, it's not a one-way street. People who don't have the right to claim asylum, people who are not from Syria, from a bloody civil war, will be obviously looked at on an individual basis, but will be relentlessly thrown out as well. And I think the problem was that there was too much of a pull factor there.
Wasn't one of the pull factors that actually Merkel... and this wasn't cynical, but it did help, saw many of the refugees addressing Germany's skill and labour shortage, so that she saw it a possibility of there was something in it for her, in theory.
Yeah, there are interesting discussions about that. Of course, the Syrian doctor is the cliche. Unfortunately, it's more of, I think, the Syrian unskilled labourer. On the whole, you know, we've had studies which point out that it'll be a long haul of investing a lot of money into education of migrants before they can fill those gaps that are there. I mean, simply in terms of population, that's great, yes, because we have a shrinking population, as a lot of other continental European countries. So one thing, of course, which distinguishes us from Britain, I mean, I think that's a lot of people on the continent don't realize how much Britain has grown over the last 10, 15 years.
Equally part of that reason for growth is the younger families migrating into Britain from other parts of the European Union.
Absolutely.
The age profile.
Very productive. No, that's the shame about the immigration discussion. If I may just interject that, shame about the immigration debate here. You know, you've got great people coming here, and all you ever hear is moaning about it.
But why do you think that is? Why is the narrative so skewed? We can understand the problem. I mean, Ivan was mentioning the numbers in Germany, you know, a million people or more. That is going to cause an immediate strain. In Britain, the numbers are far more modest, but the narrative, you'd almost think, if you read certainly
the
some of the...
numbers are not more modest when you take into account Bulgarians, Romanians and all the Poles and so forth.
Well, yeah, but then you also surely...
But
in the same breath then, you must also look at the net contribution to GDP of all of those migrants, which is almost universally positive. But you don't get that narrative. Why is there such a disconnect?
I think, to be honest, I do seek fault with the Labour government of the noughties, who, you know, to their credit, opened the doors. That was part of a long-standing British policy, saying we want the former Eastern Bloc countries to be part of our European family. And part of that is that, you know, freedom of movement, so they can work here. That was 2004. Sweden, Ireland and Great Britain were the only three countries. Everybody else said 7 years. No, you can't come, basically. But at the same time, they should have foreseen the tremendous flow of people and then supported communities. I mean, you know, I reported on it in 2005-06, how communities were totally left on their own and central government didn't give them enough support. And I think that's where a lot of the resentment that is now there came from.
And that lack of longer term planning, and it's understandable, you know, political careers often work in cycles. It prompts me to ask another question, which is, if we look ahead, Ivor, next, then you see the battle on the hands of someone like Merkel. What happens? Do you worry that you see mainstream political parties, perhaps, if not stooping to the level of some of the populist rhetoric we hear, trying to, I don't know, or almost sort of implicitly borrowing some of that kind of language? Is that a worry for you?
Do you know, I've always have given up worrying. I've certainly given up predicting the future ever since I sat in this studio along with many colleagues, not predicting that Trump would be the main Republican candidate, that Bernie Sanders would be the main challenger, that there'd be no Labour MPs bar one in Scotland, etc., etc. We are in such torrid, difficult times. Tony Blair once used a phrase which I rather like, which is the kaleidoscope has been shaken and the pieces haven't yet settled. I think anybody who makes predictions about anything at the moment doesn't know what they're talking
but
about.
But what about...
But you
what
don't
about,
have
what,
to predict.
What
you
about best predict. Advice? What about best advice? What about best practice? If we don't
it
guess...
It happens. It's already happened in Holland, you know, that the mainstream party relying on an extremist party and obviously borrowing their rhetoric. It's happening in Finland. It's happening in Sweden. Unfortunately, but, you know, there's nothing you can do as a mainstream party.
And yet at the same time, we can see in Spain that the Podemos does well. In Syriza in Greece wins two elections on the trot, as I said, Bernie Sanders. So there are other movements going on at the same time. Now, I'm not whistling in the dark, and I, you know, one could make cases against them all. All I'm saying is we are in very strange times, and it is even in Germany. Well, both the, as I recall, in the other two Länder, the leading parties, the Greens and the Social Democrats, increased their vote. So there are odd things going on, but this is not to say that perhaps the mainstream reaction and looking at France, where clearly Marine Le Pen is going to probably be the main opposition, that we are in difficult times. Do I worry about it? Yes, I do.
Just finally, though, and coming back to Germany, Sebastian, what do you think the... I mean, we said it's hazardous to predict the future, but just in terms of that, the change in political narrative, this shift in the politics, the fabric of it, how's that going to manifest itself? What do you think Merkel and her advisers, how will they be discussing and analysing what's happened over the weekend after probably a couple of stiff drinks?
I think she will have to, and her team will have to agree that they've got to speed up the paths that have they've taken over the last 2-3 months. To be honest, they've been fortunate by the obstreperousness of the Austrians and the countries of the Balkans by closing down that route. So they've got a breathing space, but not more than that. Germany has to. I think she has to tell people much more clearly what she envisages the policy to be overall, and she's got to say we remain a country open to refugees. We have our very special history. We know what it's like to be a refugee, but we also have our own interests. I think and sometimes those interests collide, and I am aware of that. At least, you know, she's got to go down that route and give people an idea that she is, you know, she swore an oath to prevent damage from Germany, and people are worried that she's forgotten that.
Let's move on now on Midori House to Turkey next, and the weekend's bombing in the capital Ankara. President Erdogan announced a crackdown on the Kurdish PKK group in the country's southeast and across into Iraq in response to that explosion, which left dozens dead and scores more injured. Ivor, let me ask you first of all, the narrative from the Turkish government, from Erdogan, that the PKK is involved, is responsible for this latest attack is understandable. It certainly fits with his position. Where does it leave us in the bigger picture, though? Because obviously the position of various Kurdish groups is complex, to say the least, when we look at wider, say, Western battles with IS and so on. How does this narrative fit in your view?
When you mentioned the bigger picture, I was actually thinking of the role that Turkey is beginning to play in the debate about Brexit, about the British referendum, where the Leave people are saying, if we don't get out now, we'll be in Turkish, and the Turks will invade. And yesterday, the Treasury Minister, Chancellor of the Exchequer, said, no, not in my lifetime, the Turks won't be coming in. So actually, the fear, if you like, of the Muslim hordes in waiting in Istanbul to invade the West has become part of unfortunately, I would say, the Brexit debate. In terms of the situation between Ankara and the Kurds, you know, I look back to, was it 20 months ago, less than 2 years ago, there had been a ceasefire that seemed to be working. The Kurdish, the HKK, the Democratic Kurdish Party had done extremely well in the elections. They were talking. It all looked quite good. It looked like we might actually be moving towards some sort of decent negotiated settlement. We're not dealing, I think, and Erdogan, you know, don't know him personally, but I don't have the feeling that democracy is the most driving of the motivations behind what he does, because actually he saw his own position threatened and he really restarted. There were always infringements of the ceasefire, but you can use, if you want to break the ceasefire and really start hostilities, and that's what Erdogan did. And now we're further back because, as you say, the complications with IS and Turkey's, some people say, implicit support for IS because they've got a common enemy in the Kurds, has just complicated the system, not to mention the feared Turkish/NATO confrontation with Putin and Russia. So it is a very complex situation. Whether we can deal with it in 3 minutes remains to be seen.
No, it's definitely something of a tinderbox, isn't it? Sebastian, how dangerous is this current unrest in Turkey? I think as Ivor's summed up there, there's, you know, implications for, you know, what's happening in Syria, of course. There's implications for the Western project to tackle IS more broadly. There's implications for, you know, the migrant crisis even, because Turkey's clearly involved in that. How worried are we? How worried should we be about this seeming escalation?
Well, we don't want to worry the listeners too much.
they're a sanguine bunch. They're realistic about this.
Well, I'm glad to hear it, because they should worry. There's no doubt about it. I completely agree with Ivor in this instance. There's... Erdogan seemed to me to be on a pretty good path for a number of years, and I can't fathom what happened there. Maybe it was the perceived existential threat to his rule, which has now made him turn very hostile towards minorities, which in the end he'll have to accommodate. The PKK was more or less dead a few years ago, and it's now clearly a factor again. And the moderate Kurds are on the defensive. It doesn't look pretty at all.
But should we be that surprised about that? Because we've seen, you know, some people have, because of the sort of the frictions between Russia and Turkey, people have made some comparisons between Putin and Erdogan. These are two charismatic leaders who are very much most interested at playing to their domestic gallery. You know, should we be surprised? I'm sure Erdogan's, you know, domestic poll ratings improve. We know that this kind of nationalist aggressive agenda plays very well to that audience.
Sure.
Should it be surprising, even given his maybe, you know, some positive steps that he was making a few years earlier?
But if you have every 6, 8, 12 weeks a bloody bomb like that in your capital or in your biggest city, Istanbul, then, you know, I can't quite see how that will in the medium and long term help him, because people will obviously, to start with, there'll be an effect of solidarity, but sooner or later they will ask, well, why are we suddenly that much more insecure than we used to be? And it's obvious why that is.
And Ivor, just on the sort of these wider frictions, we've seen Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov accuse Turkey of sort of creeping expansion in Syria. We learned today from pronouncements from Putin that Russia's going to roll back most of its military presence, suggesting that its work is largely done. Do you think we'll see Turkey jockeying to fill more of that vacuum? Erdogan certainly seems to wear his increasing influence fairly, well, he seems to wear it quite lightly at least.
Yeah, but I mean, we don't know what's going to happen in the Paris peace talks, which are, I think, due to start tomorrow. And there is the faintest of faint hopes that there might be some progress there. But you've mentioned two strong men. There's a third. There's Assad in Syria, who seems as stubborn as the other two. And, you know, when two immovable forces meet, it's the poor bloody infantry that gets hurt. I mean, until there is some movement on that, I see very little chance of Turkey pulling back. I think Putin has pulled back is tactical rather than strategic.
We don't believe a word of this.
It's tactical. It's pretending to be making his contribution to the peace process. And when it breaks down, as I fear it will, and back they go. Even through the ceasefire, I was hearing a report from another radio station suggesting that, in particularly in those regions where the Kurds are, the Russians have continued bombing, putting Erdogan's personal battle against the Kurds above Syrian peace talks. So it's very difficult to find any optimism at the moment, apart from the nascent peace talks, and we'll see how far they go.
And we can but hope. Well, let's cross the pond. Time is short, and I wanted to ask you both briefly about tomorrow's White House.
Oh, you're going to cheer us up with White House Donald Trump.
I looked around at possible topics, and I frankly couldn't find any. The race for the White House continues. Five states hold primaries, the most critical implications probably for the Republicans, where frontrunner Donald Trump could all but wrap up the nomination he needs to defeat Marco Rubio and John Kasich in their home states of Florida and Ohio, respectively. From our perch here in Europe, Sebastian, it's quite a crucial day. What's at stake in Florida? Once again, Florida, often a battleground. Is it all to play for the GOP?
Fascinating. I mean, the homegrown senator, someone from the very strong Latino minority is what, 20 points behind? I mean, it's unbelievable.
But how did we get here? I know we sort of pick up on this almost daily on this program, but
I'll tell you how we got here. I was thinking about this for
finally we'll hear.
Yeah, I mean, the Republican Party, establishment and all, are sowing what they have reaped. We're reaping what they have sowed. For the last 8 years under Obama, they have created this anger. They have been telling people that this government is the most outrageous
un-American,
disloyal. Is Obama even American, etc.? Blocking government process, being okay, there's always a tension between Congress and the president, but they have made the American Constitution unworkable, and they are now reaping what they have sowed. They have created Donald Trump, and they're going to suffer. They might even lose control of Congress as a result of the monster that they've created. That's my theory.
I think it's reasonable, to be fair. What do you think, Sebastian, in terms of where this race goes? A lot of sort of moderates, if you like, within the GOP were saying, well, look, we could still go to party, you know, sort of conference and try and derail Trump at that stage. But it does seem that he's got momentum. It was sufficient that he'll be able to ride that out. Do we just need to, I don't know, acclimatize ourselves to the fact that it could be Trump versus Hillary.
Yes, I certainly do think so. Because honestly, I mean, you can't see the Republican establishment having done what Ivor quite rightly describes, to then turn around and say, "Well, no, guys, now we'll stitch it up at the convention."
We've gone a bit too far.
They've lost all credibility.
Who? Please tell me who.
Well, Kasich is the only feasible one. And let me end on a positive. If Kasich is governor of Ohio, the most popular governor Ohio has said since records began, if he wins Ohio tomorrow, which seems more than likely, and Trump trips up somewhere and possibly not, then there's just possible that he could be the centrist candidate. But I don't believe it.
That's a sobering thought. Well, in a word or two then, what will happen to the GOP next then, Ivor? To follow your logic, they're presumably facing an existential crisis. Does the party split? What would happen next?
Well, of course, the other irony of this whole thing is that as various Republican establishment people have been saying, Trump ain't no Republican. He's in favour of government intervention. He's in favour of he's against free trade, which is a creed de cœur of Republicans.
Well, he isn't. It seems to depend what side of the bed he gets out on, what he's right, in favour of
like,
and against.
Like much of it. But I mean, I do think the Republicans are facing existential crisis. It began, we didn't begin, but when you had the radical right, the Christian right, and then the Tea Party movement, and then encouraged by, all these movements were encouraged by the Republican establishment. I think they're facing an existential crisis. I don't know. Will they split? The American political system, like the British system, is very unsympathetic to party splitting. First past the post makes it very difficult. So maybe they'll struggle on, but I think they're going to take a whopping at the polls.
Sebastian, last word to you. Is that the reading as well? Do you share that analysis?
That's our wishful thinking anyway.
A hiding at the ballot box, and then
absolutely.
It remains
to be
seen.
And then they'll pull back from the extremism, just like the Labour Party will soon ditch Jeremy Corbyn and pull back into mainstream politics.
On the other hand, I would love to be the fly on the wall when President Trump meets Prime Minister Corbyn. That would be an interesting conversation.
I don't know. I think we just need to have a moment for that thought to sink in. Sobering thoughts, but an upbeat note, almost comedic one, which to end after some pretty hard-hitting thoughts in this programme. Sebastian Borger, Ivor Gaber, thank you both very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's programme. The show was produced by Henry Rees-Sheridan, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Maddie Giusti and Charlie Young, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Music next, 1900, it's Culture with Robert Bound, and we'll have more on all the big stories of the day on The Daily at 2200 with Paul Osborne. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Do join us then. Goodbye.